tiny moths swirl in the lantern light. Fatigue settles into every part of Werner. Is this Dr. Hauptmann's idea of a reward or a punishment? He longs to sit on the benches in Children's House again, to hear Frau Elena's songs, to feel the heat pumping off the potbelly stove, and the high voice of Siegfried Fischer rhapsodizing about U-boats and fighter planes. To see Jutta drawing at the far end of the table, sketching out the thousand windows of her imaginary city. Inside the truck box lives a smell. Clay, spilled diesel mixed with something putrid. Three square windows reflect the lantern light. It's a radio truck. On a bench along the left wall sit a pair of grimy listening decks the size of bed pillows. A folding RF antenna that can be raised and lowered from inside. Three headsets, a weapon rack, storage lockers. Wax pencils, compasses, maps. And here, in battered cases, wait two of the transceivers he designed with Dr. Hauptmann. To see them all the way out here soothes him, as though he has turned and found an old friend floating beside him in the middle of the sea. He tugs the first transceiver from its case and unscrews the back plate. Its meter is cracked, several fuses are blown, and the transmitter plug is missing. He fishes for tools, a socket key, copper wire. He looks out the open door across the silent camp to where stars are spun in thousands across the sky. Do Russian tanks wait out there, training their guns on the lantern light? He remembers Herr Siedler's big walnut Philco. Stare into the wires, concentrate, assess. Eventually a pattern will assert itself. When he next looks up, a soft glow shows behind a line of distant trees, as if something is burning there. Dawn. A half mile away, two boys with sticks slouch behind a drove of bony cattle. Werner is opening the second transceiver case when a giant appears in the back of the truck shell.
Fennig.
The man hangs his long arms from the top bar of the truck canopy. He eclipses the ruined village, the fields, the rising sun. Volkheimer? One Ordinary Loaf. They stand in the kitchen with the curtains drawn. She still feels the exhilaration of leaving the bakery with the warm weight of the loaf in her knapsack. Etienne tears apart the bread.
There.
He sets a tiny paper scroll no bigger than a cowrie shell in her palm.
What does it say?
Numbers. Lots of them. The first three might be frequencies, I can't be sure. The fourth, 2300, might be an hour.
Will we do it now?
We will wait until it's dark.
Etienne works the wires up through the house, threading them behind the walls, connecting one to a bell on the third floor beneath the telephone table, another to a second bell in the attic, and a third to the front gate. Three times he has Marie-Laure test it. She stands in the street and swings open the outer gate, and from deep inside the house come two faint rings. Next he builds a false back onto the wardrobe, installing it on a sliding track so it can be opened from either side. At dusk they drink tea and chew the mealy, dense bread from the Ruel's bakery. When it is fully dark, Marie-Laure follows her great-uncle up the stairs, through the sixth-floor room, and up the ladder into the attic. Etienne raises the heavy telescoping antenna alongside the line of the chimney. He flips switches, and the attic fills with a delicate crackle.
Ready?
He sounds like her father when he was about to say something silly. In her memory, Marie-Laure hears the two policemen.
People have been arrested for less.
And Madame Manic. Don't you want to be alive before you die?
Yes.
He clears his throat. He switches on the microphone and says,
567. 32. 3011. 50506. 110. 90.
146-7751. Off go the numbers, winging out across rooftops, across the sea, flying to who knows what destinations. To England, to Paris, to the dead. He switches to a second frequency and repeats the transmission. A third. Then he shuts the whole thing off. The machine ticks as it cools.
What do they mean, Uncle?
I don't know.
Do they translate into words?
I suppose they must.
They go down the ladder and clamber out through the wardrobe. No soldiers wait in the hall with guns drawn. Nothing seems different at all. A line comes back to Marie-Laure from Jules Verne. Science, my lad, is made up of mistakes, but they are mistakes which it is useful to make, because they lead little by little to the truth. Etienne laughs as though to himself.
Do you remember what Madame said about the boiling frog?
Yes, Uncle.
I wonder, who was supposed to be the frog? Her or the Germans?
Folkheimer. The engineer is a taciturn, pungent man named Walter Berndt, whose pupils are misaligned. The driver is a gap-toothed 30-year-old they call Neumann One. Werner knows that Folkheimer, their sergeant, cannot be older than 20, but in the hard, pewter-colored light of the dawn, he looks twice that.
Partisans are hitting the trains, he explains. They are organized, and the captain believes they're coordinating their attacks with radios.
The last technician, says Neumann One, didn't find anything.
It's good equipment, says Werner. I should have them functioning in an hour.
A gentleness flows into Folkheimer's eyes and hangs there a moment. Fennig, he says, looking at Werner, is nothing like our last technician. They begin. The Opel bounces down roads that are hardly more than cattle trails. Every few miles they stop and set up a transceiver on some hump or ridge. They leave Berndt and skinny, leering Neumann II, one with a rifle and the other wearing headphones. Then they drive a few hundred yards, enough to build the base of a triangle, calculating distance all the way, and Werner switches on the primary receiver. He raises the truck's aerial, puts on the headset, and scans the spectra, trying to find anything that is not sanctioned. Any voice that is not allowed. Along the flat, immense horizon, multiple fires seem always to be burning. Most of the time, Werner rides facing backward, looking at the land they are leaving, back toward Poland, back into the Reich. No one shoots at them. Few voices come shearing out of the static, and the ones he does hear are German. At night, Neumann One pulls tins of little sausages out of ammunition boxes, and Neumann Two makes tired jokes about whores he remembers or invents, and in nightmares Werner watches the shapes of boys close over Frederick, though when he draws closer, Frederick transforms into Jutta, and stares at Werner with accusation while the boys carry off her limbs one by one. Every hour, Folkheimer pokes his head into the back of the Opel and meets Werner's eyes.
Nothing?
Werner shakes his head. He fiddles with the batteries, reconsiders the antennas, triple-checks fuses. At Schulpforte, with Dr. Hauptmann, it was a game. He could guess Folkheimer's frequency. He always knew whether Folkheimer's transmitter was transmitting. Out here, he doesn't know how or when or where, or even if transmissions are being broadcast. Out here, he chases ghosts. All they do is expend fuel, driving past smoldering cottages and chewed-up artillery pieces and unmarked graves, while Folkheimer passes his giant hand over his close-cropped head, growing more uneasy by the day. From miles away comes the thunder of big guns, and still the German transport trains are being hit, bending tracks and flipping cattle cars and maiming the Führer's soldiers and filling his officers with fury.
Is that a partisan there? That old man with the saw cutting trees? That one leaning over the engine of that car? What about those three women collecting water at the creek?
Frosts show up at night, throwing a silver sheet across the landscape, and Werner wakes in the back of the truck with his fingers mashed in his armpits and his breath showing and the tubes of the transceiver glowing a faint blue.
How deep will the snow be?
6 feet? 10? 100?
Miles deep, thinks Werner. We will drive over everything that once was.
Fall. Storms rinse the sky, the beaches, the streets, and a red sun dips into the sea, setting all the west-facing granite in Saint-Malo on fire, and three limousines with wrapped mufflers glide down the Rue de la Crosse like wraiths, and a dozen or so German officers, accompanied by men carrying stage lights and movie cameras, climb the steps to the Bastion de la Hollande and stroll the ramparts in the cold. From his fifth-floor window, Etienne watches them through a brass telescope, nearly 20 in all. Captains and majors and even a lieutenant colonel holding his coat at the collar and gesturing at forts on the outer islands. One of the enlisted men trying to light a cigarette in the wind, the others laughing as his hat goes flying over the battlements. Across the street from the front door of Claude Levite's house, three women spill out laughing. Lights burn in Claude's windows, though the rest of the block has no electricity. Someone opens a third-story window and throws out a shot glass, and off it goes, spinning, over and over, down toward the Rue Vauborel and out of sight. Etienne lights a candle and climbs to the sixth floor. Marie-Laure has fallen asleep. From his pocket he takes a coil of paper and unrolls it. He has already given up trying to crack the code. He has written out the numbers, gridded them, added, multiplied. Nothing has come out of it. And yet it has. Because Etienne has stopped feeling nauseated in the afternoons. His vision has stayed clear, his heart untroubled. Indeed, it has been over a month since he has had to curl up against the wall in his study and pray that he does not see ghosts shambling through the walls. When Marie-Laure comes through the front door with the bread, when he's opening the tiny scroll in his fingers, lowering his mouth to the microphone, he feels unshakable. He feels alive.
5678-21-4567-1094-467813.
Then the time and frequency for the next broadcast. They have been at it for several months, new slips of paper arriving inside a loaf of bread every few days. And lately, Etienne plays music. Always at night and never more than a shard of song. 60 or 90 seconds at most.
Debussy, or Ravel, or Massenet, or Charpentier.
He sets the microphone in the bell of his electrophone as he did years before, and lets the record spin. Who listens? Etienne imagines shortwave receivers disguised as oatmeal boxes, or tucked under floorboards. Receivers buried beneath flagstones or concealed inside bassinets. He imagines 2 or 3 dozen listeners up and down the coast, maybe more tuning in out at sea. Captains' sets on free ships hauling tomatoes, or refugees, or guns. Englishmen who expect the numbers but not the music, who must wonder, why? Tonight he plays Vivaldi, L'Autunno Allegro, a record his brother bought at a shop on the Rue Sainte-Marguerite 4 decades ago for 55 centimes. A harpsichord plucks along, the violins making big Baroque flourishes, the low, angled space of the attic brims with sound. Beyond the slates, a block away and 30 yards below, 12 German officers smile for cameras.
Listen to this, thinks Etienne. Hear this.
Someone touches his shoulder. He has to brace himself against the sloping wall to avoid falling over. Marie-Laure stands behind him in her nightdress. The violins spiral down, then back up. Etienne takes Marie-Laure's hand and together, beneath the low, sloping roof, the record spinning, the transmitter sending it over the ramparts, right through the bodies of the Germans and out to sea. They dance. He spins her. Her fingers flicker through the air. In the candlelight she looks of another world, her face all freckles, and in the center of the freckles those two eyes hang unmoving like the egg cases of spiders. They do not track him, but they do not unnerve him either. They seem almost to see into a separate, deeper place, a world that consists only of music. Graceful, lean, coordinated as she whirls, though how she knows what dancing is, he could never guess. The song plays on. He lets it go too long. The antenna is still up, probably dimly visible against the sky. The whole attic might as well shine like a beacon. But in the candlelight, in the sweet rush of the concerto, Marie-Laure bites her lower lip, and her face gives off a secondary glow, reminding him of the marshes beyond the town walls, in those winter dusks when the sun has set but isn't fully swallowed, and big patches of reeds catch red pools of light and burn. Places he used to go with his brother in what seems like lifetimes ago. This, he thinks, is what the numbers mean. The concerto ends. A wasp goes tap, tap, tap along the ceiling. The transmitter remains on, the microphone tucked into the bell of the electrophone as the needle traces the outermost groove. Marie-Laure breathes heavily, smiling. After she has gone back to sleep, after Etienne has blown out his candle, he kneels for a long time beside the bed. The bony figure of death rides the streets below, stopping his mount now and then to peer into windows. Horns of fire on his head and smoke leaking from his nostrils and, in his skeletal hand, a list newly charged with addresses. Gazing first at the crew of officers unloading from their limousines into the chateau. Then at the glowing rooms of the perfumer Claude Levite. Then at the tall dark house of Etienne LeBlanc. Pass us by, horseman. Pass this house by.
Sunflowers. They drive a dusty track surrounded by square miles of dying sunflowers so tall that they seem like trees. The stems have dried and stiffened, and the faces bob like praying heads, and as the opal bellows past, Werner feels as if they are being watched by 10,000 cyclopic eyes. Neumann I breaks the truck, and Bernd unslings his rifle and takes the second transceiver, and wades alone into the stalks to set it up. Werner raises the big antenna and sits in his usual spot in the box of the opal with his headset on. Up in the cab, Neumann II says,
"You never scrambled her eggs, you old virgin."
"Shut your mouth," says Neumann I.
"You jerk yourself to sleep at night, bleed your weasel, pound your flounder."
"So does half the army, Germans and Russians alike."
"Little pubescent Aryan back there is definitely a flounder pounder."
Over the transceiver, Bernd reads off frequencies. Nothing, nothing, nothing. Neumann I says,
"The true Aryan is as blonde as Hitler, as slim as Goering, and as tall as Goebbels."
Laughter from Neumann II.
"Fuck if..."
Volkheimer says,
"Enough."
It's late afternoon. All day they have moved through the strange and desolate region and have seen nothing but sunflowers. Werner runs the needle through the frequencies, switches bands, retunes the transceiver again, scouring the static. The air swarms with it day and night, a great, sad, sinister Ukrainian static that seems to have been here long before humans figured out how to hear it. Volkheimer clambers out of the truck and lowers his trousers and pees into the flowers, and Werner decides to trim the aerial. But before he does, he hears, as sharp and clear and menacing as the blade of a knife flashing in the sun, a volley of Russian. Adin, Shest, Vosyam. Every fiber of his nervous system leaps awake.
He turns up the volume as far as it will go and presses the headphones against his ears. Again it comes. Ponye something feshki. Shera something doroshoi. Folkheimer is looking at him through the open back of the truck shell as though he can sense it. As though he is coming awake for the first time in months. As he did that night out in the snow when Hauptmann fired his pistol when they realized Werner's transceivers worked. Werner turns the fine-tuned dial fractionally, and abruptly the voice booms into his ears. Dvi not set, scheist not set, daft set adin. Nonsense. Terrible nonsense. Pipelined directly into his head. It's like reaching into a sack full of cotton and finding a razor blade inside. Everything constant and undeviating. And then that one dangerous thing so sharp you can hardly feel it open your skin. Folkheimer wraps his massive fist on the side of the opal to quiet the Neumanns. And Werner relays the channel to Berndt on the far transceiver. And Berndt finds it and measures the angle and relays it back, and now Werner settles in to do the math. The slide rule, the trigonometry, the map. The Russian is still talking when Werner pulls his headset down around his neck. North-northwest. How far? Only numbers, pure math. 1.5 kilometers. Are they broadcasting now? Werner closes one cup of the headphones over an ear. He nods. Neumann 1 starts the opal with a roar, and Berndt comes crashing back through the flowers carrying the first transceiver, and Werner withdraws the aerial, and they grind off the road and directly through the sunflowers, punching them down as they go. The tallest are nearly as tall as the truck, and their big dry heads drum the roof of the cab and the sides of the box. Neumann 1 watches the odometer and calls out distances. Folkheimer distributes weapons. 2 carabiner 98Ks. The Walther semi-automatic with the scope. Beside him, Berndt loads cartridges into the magazine of his Mauser. Bong, go the sunflowers. Bong, bong, bong. The truck yaws like a ship at sea as Neumann 1 coaxes it over ruts. 1,100 meters! Calls Neumann 1, and Neumann 2 scrambles onto the hood of the truck and peers above the field with binoculars. To the south, the flowers give way to a patch of raveled gherkins. Beyond those, ringed by bare dirt, stand a pretty cottage with a thatched roof and stucco walls. The line of yarrow, end of the field. Folkheimer raises his scope. Any smoke? None. An antenna? Hard to say. Shut off the motor. On foot from here. Everything goes quiet. Folkheimer, Neumann 2, and Berndt carry their weapons into the flowers and are swallowed. Neumann 1 stays behind the wheel, Werner in the truck shell. No landmines explode in front of them. All around the opal, the flowers creak on their stems and nod their heliotropic faces, as if in some sad accord. "Fuckers are gonna be surprised," whispers Neumann 1. His right thigh jogs up and down several times a second. Behind him, Werner raises the aerial as high as he dares and clamps on the headphones and switches on the transceiver. The Russian is reading what sounds like letters of the alphabet. Pe. Ze, ka, che, you, myaki, znak. Each utterance seems to rise from the oral cotton for Werner's ears alone, then melts away. Neumann 1's vibrating leg shakes the truck lightly, and the sun flares through the remnants of insects smeared across the window, and a cold wind sets the whole field rustling. Won't there be sentries? Lookouts? Armed partisans sidling up right now behind the truck? The Russian on the radio is a hornet in each ear. Zvo, Kaz, Vukalov. Who knows what horrors he's dispensing? Troop positions, train schedules. He might be giving artillery gunners the truck's location right now, and Volkheimer is walking out of the sunflowers, as large a target as a human has ever presented, holding his rifle like a baton. It seems impossible that the cottage could ever accommodate him, as though Volkheimer will engulf the house instead of the other way around. First, the shots come through the air around the headphones. A fraction of a second later, they come through the headphones themselves, so loud that Werner almost tears them off. Then even the static cuts out, and the silence in the headphones feels like something massive moving through space, a ghostly airship slowly descending. Neumann 1 opens and closes the bolt of his rifle. Werner remembers crouching next to his cot with Jutta after the Frenchman would sign off, the windows rattling from some passing coal train, the echo of the broadcast seeming to glimmer in the air for a moment, as though he could reach out and let it float down into his hands. Volkheimer returns with ink spattered on his face. He raises two huge fingers to his forehead, pushes his helmet back, and Werner can see that it is not ink. "Set the house afire," he says. "Quickly. Don't waste diesel." He looks at Werner, his voice tender, almost melancholy. "Salvage the equipment." Werner sets down the headphones, puts on his helmet. Swifts swoop out over the sunflowers. His vision makes slow loops as though something has gone wrong with his balance. Neumann 1 hums in front of him as he carries a can of fuel through the stalks. They break through the sunflowers toward the cottage, stepping through Aaron's rod, wild carrot, all the leaves browned from the frost. Beside the front door, a dog lies in the dust, chin on its paws, and for a moment, Werner thinks it's only sleeping. The first dead man is on the floor with an arm trapped beneath him and a crimson mess where his head should be. On the table is a second man, slumped as if sleeping on his ear, only the edges of his wound showing a whorish purple. Blood that has spread across the table thickens like cooling wax. It looks almost black. Strange to think of his voice still flying through the air, already a country away, growing weaker every mile. Torn pants, grimy jackets, one of the men in suspenders. They do not wear uniforms. Neumann 1 tears down a potato sack curtain and takes it outside, and Werner can hear him splash it with diesel. Neumann 2 pulls the suspenders off the second dead man and takes some braided shallots from the lintel and bundles them against his chest and leaves. In the kitchen, a small brick of cheese sits half-eaten, a knife beside it with a faded wooden handle. Werner opens a single cupboard. Inside dwells a den of superstition. Jars of dark liquids, unlabeled pain remedies, molasses, tablespoons stuck to the wood. Something marked in Latin, belladonna, something else marked with an X. The transmitter is poor, high frequency, probably salvaged from a Russian tank. It seems little more than a handful of components shoveled into a box. The ground plane antenna installed beside the cottage must have sent the transmissions 30 miles, if that. Werner goes out, looks back at the house, bone white in the failing light. He thinks of the kitchen cupboard with its strange potions, the dog that did not do its job. These partisans may have been involved in some dark forest magic, but they should not have been tinkering with the higher magic of radio. He slings his rifle and carries the big battered transmitter, its leads, its inferior microphone, through the flowers to the opal, its engine running, Neumann 2 and Volkheimer already in the cab. He hears Dr. Hauptmann. A scientist's work is determined by two things, his interests and those of his time. Everything has led to this. The death of his father, all those restless hours with Jutta listening to the crystal radio in the attic, Hans and Heribert wearing their red armbands under their shirts so Frau Elena would not see, 400 dark, glittering nights at Schubforte building transceivers for Dr. Hauptmann, the destruction of Frederick. Everything leading to this moment as Werner piles the haphazard Cossack equipment into the shell of the truck and sits with his back against the bench, and watches the light from the burning cottage rise above the field. Bernd climbs in beside him, rifle in his lap, and neither bothers to close the back door when the Opel roars into gear. Stones. Sergeant Major von Rumpel is summoned to a warehouse outside Łódź. It is the first time he has traveled since completing his treatments in Stuttgart, and he feels as though the density of his bones has decreased. Six guards in steel helmets wait inside razor wire. Much heel-clicking and saluting ensues. He takes off his coat and steps into a zippered jumpsuit with no pockets. Three deadbolts give way. Through a door, four enlisted men in identical jumpsuits stand behind the tables with jeweler's lamps bolted to each. Plywood has been nailed all over the windows. A dark-haired Gefreiter explains the protocol. A first man will pry the stones out of their settings. A second will scrub them one by one in a bath of detergent. A third will weigh each, announce its mass, and pass it to von Rumpel, who will examine the stone through a loop and call out the clarity. Included. Slightly included. Almost loop clean. A fifth man, the Gefreiter, will record the assessments. We will work in 10-hour shifts until we're done. Von Rumpel nods. Already his spine feels as if it might splinter. The Gefreiter drags a padlocked sack from beneath his table, unthreads a chain from its throat, and upends it onto a velvet-lined tray. Thousands of jewels spill out. Emeralds, sapphires, rubies, citrine, peridot, chrysoberyl. Among them twinkle hundreds upon hundreds of little diamonds, most still in necklaces, bracelets, cufflinks, or earrings. The first man carries the tray to his station, sets an engagement ring in his vise, and peels back the prongs with his tweezers. Down the line comes the diamond. Von Rumpel counts the other bags beneath the table. 9. Where, he begins to ask, did they all... But he knows where they came from. Grotto. Months after the death of Madame Manic, Marie-Laure still waits to hear the old woman come up the stairs, her labored breathing, her sailor's drawl. Jesus, mother child, it's freezing. She never comes. Shoes at the foot of the bed beneath the model. Cane in its corner. Down to the first floor where her knapsack hangs on its peg. Out. 22 paces down the Rue Vauburel. Then right for 16 storm drains. Turn left on the Rue Robert Surcouf. 9 more drains to the bakery. 1 ordinary loaf, please. And how is your uncle? My uncle is well, thank you. Sometimes the loaf has a white scroll inside, and sometimes it does not. Sometimes Madame Ruel has managed to procure a few groceries for Marie-Laure. Cabbage, red peppers, soap. Back to the intersection with the Rue d'Estrée. Instead of turning left onto the Rue Vauburel, Marie-Laure continues straight. 50 steps to the ramparts, 100 or so more along the base of the walls to the mouth of the alley that grows ever narrower. With her fingers she finds the lock. From her coat she pulls the iron key Harold Bazin gave her a year before. The water is icy and shin-deep. Her toes go numb in an instant, but the grotto itself comprises its own slick universe, and inside this universe spin countless galaxies. Here, in the upturned half of a single mussel shell, lives a barnacle and a tiny spindle shell occupied by a still smaller hermit crab. And on the shell of the crab, a yet smaller barnacle. And on that barnacle? In the damp box of the old kennel, the sound of the sea washes away all other sounds. She tends to the snails as though to plants in a garden. Tide to tide, moment to moment, she comes to listen to the creatures suck and shift and squeak, to think of her father in his cell, of Madame Manic in her field of Queen Anne's lace, of her uncle confined for 2 decades inside his own house. Then she feels her way back to the gate and locks it behind her. That winter, the electricity is out more than it is on. Etienne links a pair of marine batteries to the transmitter so that he can broadcast when the power is off. They burn crates and papers and even antique furniture to keep warm. Marie-Laure drags the heavy rag rug from the floor of Madame Manic's apartment all the way to the 6th floor and drapes it over her quilt. Some midnights her room grows so cold that she half believes she can hear frost settling onto the floor. Any footfall in the street could be a policeman. Any rumble of an engine could be a detachment sent to haul them away. Upstairs, Etienne broadcasts again, and she thinks, I should station myself by the front door in case they come. I could buy him a few minutes. But it is too cold. Far better to stay in bed beneath the weight of the rug and dream herself back into the museum. Trail her fingers along remembered walls, make her way across the echoing grand gallery toward the key pound. All she has to do is cross the tiled floor and turn left, and there Papa will be behind the counter, standing at his key cutter. He'll say, What took you so long, Bluebird? He'll say, I will never leave you, not in a million years.
Hunting. In January 1943, Werner finds a second illegal transmission coming from an orchard on which a shell has fallen, cracking most of the trees in half. 2 weeks later, he finds a third, then a fourth. Each new find seems only a variation of the last. The triangle closes in, each segment shrinking simultaneously, the vertices growing closer until they are reduced to a single point. A barn, or a cottage, or a factory basement, or some disgusting encampment in the ice.
He is broadcasting now?
Yes.
In that shed?
Do you see the antenna along the eastern wall?
Whenever he can, Werner records what the partisans say on magnetic tape. Everybody, he is learning, likes to hear themselves talk. Hubris, like the oldest stories. They raise the antenna too high, broadcast for too many minutes, assume the world offers safety and rationality when, of course, it does not. The captain sends word that he is thrilled with their progress. He promises holiday leaves, steaks, brandy. All winter the Opal roves occupied territories. Cities that Jutta recorded in their radio log coming to life. Prague, Minsk, Ljubljana. Sometimes the truck passes a group of prisoners, and Folkheimer asks Neumann 1 to slow. He sits up very straight, looking for any man as large as he is. When he sees one, he raps the dash. Neumann 1 brakes, and Folkheimer postholes out into the snow, speaks to a guard, and wades in among the prisoners, usually wearing only a shirt against the cold.
His rifle is in the truck, Neumann 1 will say. Left his fucking rifle right here.
Sometimes he's too far away. Other times Werner hears him perfectly. Ausziehen, Folkheimer will say, his breath pluming out in front of him, and almost every time the big Russian will understand. Take it off. A strapping Russian boy with the face of someone for whom no remaining thing on earth could be surprising. Except, perhaps this, another giant wading toward him. Off come the mittens, a wool shirt, a battered coat. Only when he asks for their boots do their faces change. They shake their heads, look up or look down, roll their eyes like frightened horses. To lose their boots, Werner understands, means they will die. But Folkheimer stands and waits. Big man against big man, and always the prisoner caves. He stands in his wrecked socks in the trampled snow, and tries to make eye contact with the other prisoners. But none will look at him. Folkheimer holds up various items, tries them on, hands them back if they do not fit.
Then he stamps back to the truck and Neumann 1 drops the opal into gear. Creaking ice, villages burning in forests, nights where it becomes too cold even to snow. That winter presents a strange and haunted season during which Werner prowls the static, like he used to prowl the alleys with Jutta, pulling her in the wagon through the colonies of Solverein. A voice materializes out of the distortion in his headphones, then fades, and he goes ferreting after it. There, thinks Werner when he finds it again. There. A feeling like shuttering your eyes and feeling your way down a mile-long thread until your fingernails find the tiny lump of a knot. Sometimes days pass after hearing the first transmission, before Werner snares the next. They present a problem to solve. Something to wrap his mind around. Better, surely, than fighting in some stinking frozen trench full of lice, the way the old instructors at Schulpfort have fought in the First War. This is cleaner, more mechanical. A war waged through the air, invisibly, and the front lines are anywhere. Isn't there a kind of ravishing delight in the chase of it? The truck bouncing along through the darkness, the first signs of an antenna through the trees. I hear you. Needles in the haystack. Thorns in the paw of the lion. He finds them, and Folkheimer plucks them out. All winter the Germans drive their horses and sledges and tanks and trucks over the same roads, packing down the snow, transforming it into a slick, blood-stained ice cement. And when April finally comes, reeking of sawdust and corpses, the canyon walls of snow give way while the ice on the roads remains stubbornly fixed, a luminous internecine network of invasion, a record of the crucifixion of Russia. One night they cross a bridge over the Dnieper, with the domes and blooming trees of Kiev looming ahead, and ash blowing everywhere, and prostitutes bundled in the alleys. In a café they sit two tables down from an infantryman not much older than Werner. He stares into a newspaper with twitching eyeballs and sips coffee and looks deeply surprised, astonished. Werner cannot stop studying him. Finally, Neumann 1 leans over. Know why he looks like that? Werner shakes his head. Frostbite took his eyelids, poor bastard. Mail does not reach them. Months pass, and Werner does not write to his sister. The messages. Occupation authorities decree that every house must have a list of its occupants fixed to the door. Monsieur Etienne Leblanc, age 62. Mademoiselle Marie-Laure Leblanc, age 15. Marie-Laure tortures herself with daydreams of feasts laid out on long tables. Platters of sliced pork loin, roasted apples, banana flambé, pineapples with whipped cream. One morning in the summer of 1943, she walks to the bakery in a slow-falling rain. The queue stretches out the door. When Marie-Laure finally reaches the head of the line, Madame Ruel takes her hands and speaks very softly. Ask if he can also read this. Beneath the loaf comes a folded piece of paper. Marie-Laure puts the loaf into her knapsack and bunches the paper in her fist. She passes over a ration ticket, finds her way directly home, and deadbolts the door behind her. Etienne shuffles downstairs.
What does it say, Uncle?
It says, Monsieur Droguet wants his daughter in Saint-Coulomb to know that he is recovering well.
She said it's important.
What does it mean?
Marie-Laure removes her knapsack and reaches inside and tears off a hunk of bread. She says,
I think it means that Monsieur Droguet wants his daughter to know that he's all right.
Over the next weeks, more notes come. A birth in Saint-Vincent. A dying grandmother in La Mer. Madame Jardinier in La Rabanne wants her son to know that she forgives him.
if secret messages lurk inside these missives, if Monsieur Feuillu had a heart attack and passed gently away means blow up the switching yard at Rennes, Etienne cannot say. What matters is that people must be listening, that ordinary citizens must have radios, that they seem to need to hear from each other. He never leaves his house, sees no one save Marie-Laure, and yet somehow he has found himself at the nexus of a web of information. He keys the microphone and reads the numbers, then the messages. He broadcasts them on 5 different bands, gives instructions for the next transmission, and plays a bit of an old record. At most, the whole exercise takes 6 minutes. Too long. Almost certainly too long. Yet no one comes. The 2 bells do not ring. No German patrols come banging up the stairs to put bullets in their heads. Although she has them memorized, most nights Marie-Laure asks Etienne to read her the letters from her father. Tonight he sits on the edge of her bed. Today I saw an oak tree disguised as a chestnut tree. I know you will do the right thing. If you ever wish to understand, look inside Etienne's house. Inside the house. What do you think he means by writing inside the house twice? We've been over it so many times, Murray. What do you think he's doing right now? Sleeping, child. I am sure of it. She rolls onto her side and he hauls the hem of her quilts past her shoulders and blows out the candle and stares into the miniature rooftops and chimneys of the model at the foot of her bed. A memory rises. Etienne was in a field east of the city with his brother. It was the summer when fireflies showed up in Saint-Malo. And their father was very excited, building long-handled nets for his boys and giving them jars with wire to fasten over the tops. And Etienne and Henri raced through the tall grass as the fireflies floated away from them, illuming on and off, always seeming to rise just beyond their reach, as if the earth were smoldering and these were sparks that their footfalls had prodded free. Henri had said he wanted to put so many beetles in his window that ships could see his bedroom from miles away. If there are fireflies this summer, they do not come down the Rue Vauborel. Now it seems there are only shadows and silence. Silence is the fruit of the occupation. It hangs in branches, seeps from gutters. Madame Guibou, mother of the shoemaker, has left town, as has old Madame Blanchard. So many windows are dark. It's as if the city has become a library of books in an unknown language, the houses great shelves of illegible volumes, the lamps all extinguished. But there is the machine in the attic at work again. A spark in the night. A faint clattering rises from the alley, and Etienne peers through the shutters of Marie-Laure's bedroom, down 6 stories, and sees the ghost of Madame Manic standing there in the moonlight. She holds out a hand, and sparrows land one by one on her arms, and she tucks each one into her coat. Loudonville. The Pyrenees gleam. A pitted moon stands on their crests as if impaled. Sergeant Major von Rumpel takes a cab through the platinum moonlight to a commissariat and stands across from a police captain who continually drags the index and middle fingers of his left hand through his considerable mustache. The French police have made an arrest. Someone has burglarized a chalet of a prominent donor with ties to the Natural History Museum in Paris, and the burglar has been apprehended with a travel case stuffed with gems. He waits a long time. The captain reviews the fingernails of his left hand, then his right, then his left again. Von Rumpel is feeling very weak tonight. Queasy, really. The doctor says the treatments are over, that they have made their assault on the tumor, and now they must wait. But some mornings he cannot straighten after he finishes tying his shoes. A car arrives. The captain goes out to greet it. Von Rumpel watches through the window.
From the back seat, two policemen produce a frail-looking man in a beige suit with a perfect purple bruise around his left eye. Hands cuffed. A spattering of blood on his collar, as though he has just left off playing a villain in some movie. The policemen shepherd the prisoner inside while the captain removes the handbag from the car's trunk. Von Rumpel takes his white gloves from his pocket. The captain closes his office door, sets the bag atop his desk, and pulls his blinds. Tilts the shade of his desk lamp. In a room somewhere beyond, Von Rumpel can hear a cell door clang shut. From the handbag, the captain removes an address book, a stack of letters, and a woman's compact. Then he plucks out a false bottom followed by six velvet bundles. He unwraps them one at a time. The first contains three gorgeous pieces of beryl. Pink, fat, hexagonal. Inside the second is a single cluster of aqua-colored amazonite, gently striated with white. Inside the third is a pear-cut diamond. A thrill leaps into the tips of Von Rumpel's fingers. From a pocket, the captain withdraws a loop, a look of naked greed blooming on his face. He examines the diamond for a long time, turning it this way and that. Through Von Rumpel's mind sails visions of the Führer Museum. Glittering cases, bowers beneath pillars, jewels behind glass, and something else too. A faint power, like a low voltage coming off the stone, whispering to him, promising to erase his illness. Finally, the captain looks up, the impress of his loop a tight pink circle around his eye. The lamplight sets a gleam on his wet lips. He places the jewel back on the towel. From the other side of the desk, Von Rumpel picks up the diamond. Just the right weight. Cold in his fingers, even through the cotton of the gloves. Deeply saturated with blue at its edges. Does he believe? DuPont has almost kindled a fire inside it. But with the lens to his eye, Von Rumpel can see that the stone is identical to the one he examined in the museum 2 years before. He sets the reproduction back on the desk. "But at the minimum," the captain says in French, his face falling. "We must X-ray it, no?" "Do whatever you like, by all means. I'll take those letters, please." Before midnight, he is at his hotel. Two fakes. This is progress. Two found, two left to find, and one of the two must be real. For dinner, he orders wild boar cooked with fresh mushrooms, and a full bottle of Bordeaux. Especially during wartime, such things remain important. They are what separates civilized man from the barbarian. The hotel is drafty and the dining room is empty, but the waiter is excellent. He pours with grace and steps away. Once in the glass, as dark as blood, the Bordeaux seems almost as though it is a living thing. Von Rumpel takes pleasure in knowing that he is the only person in the world who will have the privilege of tasting it before it is gone. Gray. December 1943. Ravines of cold sink between the houses. The only wood left to burn is green, and the whole city smells of wood smoke. Walking to the bakery, 15-year-old Marie Lohr is as chilled as she has ever been. Indoors, it is a little better. Stray snowflakes seem to drift through the rooms, blown through the gaps in the walls. She listens to her great-uncle's footfalls across the ceiling, and his voice, 310, 1467, 507, 2222, 576881. And then her grandfather's song, Clair de Lune, strains over her like a blue mist. Airplanes make low, lazy passes over the city. Sometimes they sound so close that Marie Lohr fears they might graze the rooftops, knock over chimneys with their bellies. But no planes crash, no houses explode. Nothing seems to change at all except Marie Lohr grows.
She can no longer wear any of the clothes her father carried here in his rucksack 3 years before. And her shoes pinch. She takes to wearing 3 pairs of socks and a pair of Etienne's old tasseled loafers. The rumors are that only essential personnel and those with medical reasons will be allowed to stay in Saint-Malo.
"We're not leaving," says Etienne. "Not when we might finally be doing some good. If the doctors won't give us notes, we'll pay for them some other way."
For portions of every day, she manages to lose herself in realms of memory. The faint impressions of the visual world before she was 6, when Paris was like a vast kitchen, pyramids of cabbages and carrots everywhere, bakers' stalls overflowing with pastries, fish stacked like cordwood in the fishmongers' booths, the runnels awash in silver scales, alabaster gulls swooping down to carry off entrails. Every corner she turned billowed with color. The green of leeks, the deep purple glaze of eggplants. Now her world has turned gray. Gray faces and gray quiet. And a gray nervous terror hanging over the queue at the bakery. And the only color in the world briefly kindled when Etienne climbs the stairs to the attic, knees creaking, to read one more string of numbers into the ether, to send another of Madame Ruel's messages, to play a song. That little attic bursting with magenta and aquamarine and gold for 5 minutes. And then the radio switches off, and the gray rushes back in, and her uncle stumps back down the stairs.
Fever.
Maybe it comes from the stew in some nameless Ukrainian kitchen. Maybe partisans have poisoned the water. Maybe Werner simply sits too long in too many damp places with the headset over his ears. Regardless, the fever comes, and with it terrible diarrhea. And as Werner crouches in the mud behind the opal, he feels as if he is shitting out the last of his civilization. Whole hours pass, during which he can do no more than press his cheek against the wall of the truck shell seeking something cold. Then the shivers take over, hard and fast, and he cannot warm his body. He wants to leap into a fire. Folkheimer offers coffee. Neumann, too, offers the tablets that Werner knows by now are not for backaches. He declines both. And 1943 becomes 1944. Werner has not written Jutta in almost a year. The last letter he has from her is 6 months old and begins, "Why don't you write?" Still, he manages to find illegal transmissions, one every 2 weeks or so. He salvages the inferior Soviet equipment, milled from marginal steel, clumsily soldered. It's all so unsystematic. How can they fight a war with such lousy equipment? The resistance is pitched to Werner as supremely organized. They are dangerous, disciplined insurgents. They follow the words of ferocious, lethal leaders. But he sees firsthand how they can be so loosely allied as to be basically ineffectual. They are wretched and filthy. They live in holes. They are ragtag desperados with nothing to lose. And it seems he can never make headway into understanding which theory is closer to the truth. Because really, Werner thinks, they are all insurgents. All partisans, every single person they see. Anyone who is not a German wants the Germans dead, even the most sycophantic of them. They shy away from the truck as it rattles into town. They hide their faces, their families, their shops brim with shoes plucked off the dead. Look at them. What he feels on the worst days of that relentless winter, while rust colonizes the truck and rifles and radios, while German divisions retreat all around them, is a deep scorn for all the humans they pass. The smoking ruined villages, the broken pieces of brick in the street, the frozen corpses, the shattered walls, the upturned cars, the barking dogs, the scurrying rats and lice. How can they live like that? Out here in the forests, in the mountains, in the villages, they are supposed to be pulling up disorder by the root,
The total entropy of any system, said Dr. Hauptmann, will decrease if the entropy of another system will increase. Nature demands symmetry. Ordnung muss sein. And yet what order are